This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Since 1987, Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Luck is Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host with this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Every day we are presented with a range of sustainable products and activities, from green cleaning supplies to carbon offsets. But with so much labeled as sustainable, the term has become essentially sustainababble, at best indicating a practice or product slightly less damaging than the conventional alternative. This morning, we'll talk about how to make the term sustainability more than just a marketing term. My guest is Eric Asadourian, one of the editors of World Watch's latest State of the World 2013, Is Sustainability Possible? Eric is a senior fellow at World Watch Institute, where he has studied cultural change, consumerism, economic degrowth, ecological ethics, corporate responsibility, and sustainable communities over the past 11 years. Eric, welcome to Luck is Focus.
Thanks, Barbara. Glad to be here.
Well, thinking about the term sustainability, it seems to me that one person's sustainability or idea of sustainability is another person's idea of exactly the opposite. An example being the oil industry in Canada thinks that mining tar sands is a way of creating a sustainable oil industry in Canada and in North America, whereas many other people think that it's one of the most unsustainable practices ever devised by humankind. So how do we decide what sustainability means, and how do we maybe reframe it in a way that actually makes sense and perhaps has a slightly more leaning towards an environmental sense than some of the other uses that it has?
Sure. I think that's the challenge, is that, yes, sustainability has multiple definitions, and we lean on the ones that best suit our purposes. So when the oil industry uses that term, they're talking about financial sustainability or economic sustainability, although if they were honest, it's not even economically sustainable, because as those tar sands dwindle, and as they destroy the forests above those tar sands, generations long from now that could have sustained themselves by, you know, growing food in the forests, using agroforestry or so on, or finding other means of using the land in a way that doesn't degrade the land but actually sustains them, that would be reveals the untruth in even the use of sustainability in an economic way. But ultimately, the key is that we're talking about ecological sustainability, meaning how do we sustain ourselves, humanity? It is an anthropocentric term, I would say. How do we sustain humanity in a way that doesn't undermine, I wouldn't even say just future generations, that's often how it's talked about, but even the current generation and children today. We are so rapidly undermining Earth's systems that we're seeing climate change now, and we are going to see within this century, at minimum, at this point, 2 degrees of Celsius climate change. But in reality, even the World Bank, which is not a environmental organization at any point rate, is talking about a 4-degree future and how we need to make radical changes if we're going to stop that.
Well, you talk about economics, and one of the things I found the most fascinating in this book, Is Sustainability Still Possible, is the discussion of how economics is totally out of whack with an understanding of the laws of physics. So let's talk a little bit about entropy and how that enters into our whole understanding of sustainability.
Wow, okay.
I know that wasn't the article you wrote, but it was one that fascinated me the most.
No. I'm happy to do that. I think, more broadly, it's trying to analyze you know, economy is often treated as the be-all and end-all of measurements. Is our society successful? Well, the economy is growing, therefore, yes, it is. But if our economy is undermining the broader ecological systems that the economy depends on and that the economy is part of, I mean, it's a circle within a circle, if you will. And if we're undermining the broader systems that we basically don't count in our ledgers, right? I mean, when we're talking about a stable climate, no one's actually financializing that other than when there's a disaster and we're actually costing it out. But if we're talking about bee pollination, those are often ignored. I was actually just at the DuPont, I'm based in Washington, D.C., the DuPont Farmers Market this Sunday, and I've known one farmer for many years, and he was sharing the real tragic cost that he had this year of his blueberry crop was only a third of its normal size because winds happened to be so strong during the pollination time that none of the bees would fly out. Only the bumblebees could actually sustain those wind speeds. And so he said, you know, off the cuff, he's lost something like $20,000 this year in his blueberry crops. Because there, I mean, and those aren't numbers that are normally being factored in. You know, pollination, the actual economic value of pollination is rarely factored in other than by ecological economists. So we need to start factoring in those so that we can actually recognize that it's much more economically beneficial to not drill the tar sands, since we're using that example, than it is to drill them, get the minimal benefit of that very crude oil, the liquid bitumen, and then actually have to deal with major costs involved with both local cleanup, but also the global changes in climate that are driven in part by that.
Well, one of the things I found really fascinating in the article about, let's see, it's, I have it in front of me, but the one basically about economics and looking at having an energy baseline for our understanding of economics. And there's a discussion about basically the development of the understanding of physics, going back to Isaac Newton and the laws of thermodynamics. And there's a second law of thermodynamics, which is basically that energy and matter can be neither be created or destroyed. They just can sort of turn into one another. View has, like, that framework has been used to apply to history and to almost every other discipline that we study, except for economics. And I wanted to talk about how economics is, like, the way we understand economics actually defies the laws of nature and the laws of physics.
Yeah, well, it does. But, I mean, I think we want to take a step back then and look more at our cultures, right? Our culture somehow has celebrated economics and growth as a kind of dominant ideology, that the more we grow, the better off societies are. And realistically, there's nothing in nature that does that. Yes, children grow and, you know, infant animals grow and bacteria cultures grow, but they don't grow forever. They stabilize at adolescence and then redirect their resources in a different direction. And there's actually a great little video, a viral video that went around a few years back about the creating a metaphor for economics, and it's called The Impossible Hamster by the New Economics Foundation, and they kind of just imagined if a hamster grew like our global economy, what would happen, and within 1 year, it was eating the entire grain stores of the entire planet, if it just kept growing like it was when it was an infant and kind of in its first life stage. And within, you know, a little shortly after that, because of the exponential growth factor, it literally consumed the entire planet. And that's what our economies are doing. We aren't trying to balance them within the climate system, within even other cycles that humanity depends on but don't get as much attention as the carbon cycle, the nitrogen cycle, the phosphorus cycle. We're depleting and we're disrupting major flows of nutrients through the Earth's systems, and causing, you know, not just kind of local damage like coral reefs weakening or tropical forests being destroyed, but really major global disruptions that are going to have massive ramifications on the 7 billion people that we have now, and more likely we're going to probably stabilize around 9 or 10 billion people, and that's going to put even more pressure on us. And if we all are trying to expand consumption and growth for a population of not just 7 billion but even more, making as many of us into consumers as possible, there's going to be a massive disruption that's going to be caused by that.
Well, there's a chapter in the book called Energy is Master Resource, is what I was looking for. And I was very taken with that whole concept, because it really kind of changes, I think, the way that we stratify and organize our view of the world. What was meant by this phrase, energy as master resource?
Well, I think one of the main points of that chapter is to make it clear that there is no such thing as free energy, and that there is an amount of energy that one needs to invest to get energy back out. So that's this term, energy return on investment. So even solar power, it takes a significant energy investment to create those solar panels, often fossil fuels that are being used to make the solar panels, to ship the solar panels, to care for and eventually recycle them into more solar panels if we had a purely circular economy. And so if you actually do the analysis on how much energy you get from those solar panels once you subtract out the energy that it costs to make, then that's a very different kind of equation than if we just kind of ignore those behind-the-scenes things, right? It's the same with the tar sands versus in the early stages of oil, when it was just literally bubbling out of the ground and we could just siphon it off, we were getting a lot more energy out of that. In the chapter, the author Eric Zenke talks about 20 times the energy out on average from oil. But in other cases, tar sand is more like 5 times the energy out on average. And solar, to just give a comparison, is around 5 to 10 times. But so that means we're talking about there is going to be a lot of energy that goes in to get energy out. And the challenge is for us is that right now we're using energy wastefully, and we're not taking the majority of our energy now to create a renewable energy infrastructure. And we only have a basic amount of energy capital that we can draw on without undermining the climate system. So if we were a smart species, we would actually be moving away as rapidly as possible from burning fossil fuels just for kind of sustaining our consumer lifestyle and using most of them right now to be creating that renewable energy infrastructure so that we don't fall into what another of our authors calls an energy trap. There will be a point where we don't have enough energy to both kind of sustain our consumer lifestyle and be building a renewable energy infrastructure, and prices will increase significantly, and one of those two will give, or maybe both, depending on how long we wait. So I think one of the main points of that chapter is to really make it clear that we have to make a renewable energy transition as quickly as possible if we expect it to be smooth and if we expect to create a level of energy that we've that comes close. I wouldn't say that we've even reached, but a level of energy that comes close to our current levels.
Well, I think it was about 7 years ago, I was sitting in a week-long series of seminars for environmental journalists about a range of issues involving the environment and the West, and some of it had to do with energy and water. And there was several heated discussions about the whole idea of having a bridge energy solution to get us from our fossil fuel current dependency to the renewables of the future. And the debate was whether it was going to be natural gas or whether it was going to be nuclear power. This was back in 2006. And it seems like we haven't come very much further since then. We're still debating the same things we were debating back then. And I wonder, how do we stop debating and how do we start to move forward?
Well, the problem is, I wish I could answer that. I mean, I would say part one of that is, I think natural gas probably won that conversation, in part because of Fukushima, in part because of Germany's leadership on their energy transition, which has basically shut down nuclear there, and because of our aggressive creation of a shale gas industry here. Europe has not kind of jumped in like the United States has, but we've really done a lot of fracking, and that's brought natural gas to the forefront of our energy systems. If all that fracked gas was actually going to build solar panels and wind turbines and distribute them around the country, and there was a some sort of logic that was actually saying, okay, we are pulling out this extra amount of energy and all of it is going towards building a renewable energy infrastructure, that would be getting us maybe towards a sustainable energy system. But of course, it just cheapens the whole global supply, and so people will buy more cars, and no one will really feel the pressure to make significant changes to their lifestyles. So if anything, more energy has just kind of slowed our progress and slowed the discussion on getting us towards a sustainable energy future.
Well, if you just tuned in, we are talking this morning with Eric Asadourian, who's one of the editors of World Watch's latest State of the World 2013, Is Sustainability Possible? And that's what we're at, or sustainability is still possible, and that's what we're asking this morning. So it sounds to me like besides changing the way we do things, that before we can change the way that we relate to energy, we need to change some social assumptions and some societal behavior. So let's delineate some of the challenges we have just in changing ourselves.
Well, those challenges are so big that I am one of the more pessimistic authors on in that book. We intentionally don't answer the question, is sustainability still possible? And in fact, the closest we come is the science fiction author, Kim Stanley Robinson, has the last word. He writes the last chapter, and the title is it too late? And he answers that more positively. I mean, ultimately, the question is not, is it too late? It's how much are we going to accept losing, or positively framed, how much will we choose to save? And the answer to that question is how actively and proactively, I should say, are we going to move towards a sustainable future? And unfortunately, the social assumptions are pushing us more rapidly towards an unsustainable future, not just in people who have already internalized the culture of consumerism, I would call it, but there are marketers, there are business leaders that really want to spread this model around the world, whether it's just their industry focus, and I've done a lot of studying on consumerism, including some interesting case studies, everything from the pet industry and how there is a strategic goal of spreading pet ownership around the world, of course.
Actually, I want to get to that in a little bit because I'm going to count you. Okay. But let's talk about cars and fast food before we get to pets.
Okay, sure. Cars is another example. It's just you name the product as something as benign as donuts or disposable diapers. There is effort to spread that to new consumer populations around the world. I mean, cars is an interesting case study in part because in the United States there was so much strategic effort to normalize the car and to literally kind of push opposition to the spread of the car, which in its early days there was a lot of opposition because people, pedestrians had kind of gotten used to having a multimodal street system, bicycles, pedestrians, carriages. And there were a lot of deaths from these early kind of minimally regulated cars. So there was a lot of opposition, but the car industry used a lot of strategies that are common now but were pretty revolutionary back then. Everything from creating what are now called AstroTurf organizations, which are fake grassroots citizens groups, to fight against those real citizens groups that were trying to stop cars, buying up public transit systems like trolleys and actually dismantling them so that the car and the bus system that they partly owned as well actually becoming driven forward.
I want to interject, but I've read that in a number of places, but I've also read a couple people who debunk that, so I just can, because they're the second person I've interviewed this summer who has raised that, so I just want to know how is that substantiated, so the next time I read a debunker of that theory, I'll know who's talking the truth.
Well, I would recommend a really strong book on this topic called Fighting Traffic. It's a PhD, MIT PhD candidate whose name I will not remember off the top of my head. But he kind of did a real deep study of all the strategies. I mean, to the point where, and this is the book that I took this source from, but he went straight to the archives, to the point where they actually, car companies worked with police, local police or officer organizations to actually kind of start fining jaywalkers, right? There was even the process of the term jaywalker was not obviously in our language before cars, but there was an effort to kind of switch who was the dominant party on public streets, and the car or the pedestrian, and the creation of crosswalks and kind of fining jaywalkers and arresting jaywalkers was a way to kind of accelerate the cultural transition.
Now, the question that I had, though, was about whether it's true that the car companies actually bought up the streetcars and bus lines. Well, actually, it wasn't the bus lines, the streetcars. I mean, I heard that General Motors and some of the tire companies, you know, took over. Yeah. So, and I've heard that a number of times, but I've also, since I've heard it debunked in different ways. One time I saw it debunked by saying, well, it's true that the trolley tracks were torn up, but it's because people had already shifted from public transit to cars. And so I'm just wondering, how much can you substantiate that, in fact, it was like a conspiracy or whatever, that the car companies and the tire companies destroy public transit in the United States?
Well, I don't think it was a conspiracy as much as smart business. It was simple as, you know, you create more of your market by doing that. And while I don't feel I think the best answer I can give you right now is I will give you the sources for where I got that information, and maybe you can post it on your webpage. Is that
awesome? Would be great. Actually, if you could send me an email later week, and I will put it up on the webpage. So please do that.
Okay, great. Yeah, I will.
So then let's continue about the rest of the way that people were manipulated into out of public transit, walking, biking, and into cars. And the whole idea of going from public transit to private transit, basically.
Sure. Well, I think, I mean, I would almost rather kind of take a step back and look at just how broadly this was happening across industries, and including now. I mean, right now, there's $500 billion a year being spent on marketing, and that's normalizing around the world. About half of that, or about 40% of that marketing, is still in the United States, but that's a major decline over even a decade ago. But we're really just selling this idea that the good life comes out of how much we consume, and that the striking thing. One of my favorite chapters in this year's report is chapter 4, getting to one planet living. And what's interesting in that book is from Jenny Moore and William Rees, who was the founder of co-founder of the Ecological Footprint Measure, looking at how much of the world's resources humanity is consuming. And what they found is that they're asking the question of, okay, what does a one planet way of life really look like? Because we often hear the statistic that if everyone consumed like Americans, we'd need 5 planets, which sounds scary, but we don't really talk about what a sustainable one-planet lifestyle would look like for the 7 billion people that live on the planet right now. And if you actually look at that that kind of analysis, this is why the question you're asking, the social assumptions, how do we get over the current ones, it's a real challenge. I mean, we're talking about a one-planet lifestyle is looks more like the Cuban lifestyle than any others. I mean, if we have a good scenario, and when I say Cuba, I say that because of their high education. I mean, they actually have a lower infant mortality rate than the United States. They've prioritized healthcare and education, but have very low consumption levels. But the one planet lifestyle looks like basically no driving, no flying, just public transit access and bicycling. You have kind of smaller homes, much smaller homes. We're talking about 8 square meters, or you know, a kind of a very small space, more people per homes, and almost a vegan lifestyle. And you know, so when you're kind of mapping that out, when you're consuming a small amount of a small percentage of what we are feel entitled to today, probably don't have air conditioning. We're living in passive solar homes, so maybe we don't need air conditioning as much if they're well designed. We're not traveling on vacations anymore. You know, going back to pets, we probably don't own pets unless they're edible or productive pets like chickens. But the dog and cat are probably out. When you're talking about these major changes, if we were going to have an equitable and kind of sustainable global population of 7 billion people without undermining our climate system and many other Earth systems, it's so far from where the American wants to be or is told they want to be through marketing and through other forces that it's going to be a huge challenge to get to a truly sustainable future.
So what do we do? I mean, maybe we'll talk for a moment about pets, because this is one place where I had a little bit of an objection. I was reading along with your thing about consumerism. I mean, my dog is sitting right beside me. She does my show with me every week. And I think that I thought that the pet issue that you raised, there is, on the one hand, a great deal of hype and consumerism around pet ownership, which has changed a lot in the last 20, 30 years. But on the other hand, dogs and cats have been human companions for many, many, many millennia. So our relationship with dogs and cats started long before consumerist society. So I wonder if the two things can be separated out, and that I think there are ways to own pets that don't have a very high ecological footprint.
Well, I agree with that. There are ways. If you forego kind of the extreme stuff like dressing up your dog, flying your dog on vacation with you, those kind of obvious things. But even you also have to forego expensive cancer care, which is increasingly happening. You know, overfeeding your dog. There's a huge dog obesity epidemic in the United States.
Sort of
not surprising because there's an obesity. You know, they treat. The pet industry has tried to make the centerpiece of their marketing strategy to humanize dogs, right? To give us, make them part of our family. So we do a lot more for our dogs than ever before. But at the same time, if we're talking about small dogs, so that they're consuming a lot less, because two German Shepherds are actually consuming through their diets, consuming more in resources than the average Bangladeshi human being.
No, actually, doesn't that depend on how you feed your dogs? And if you're feeding them grain-based diets and certain kinds of meat-based diets that are dependent on industrial
Absolutely.
Agriculture?
This is based on a dry food. This is not even canned food. This is at the dry food level. So, you know, some meat content, but mostly grain. But even at that level, I mean, they're just bigger, two German Shepherds, than Bangladeshi. And Bangladeshis don't. On average, we're talking all this is averages. They're not having access to kind of the fossil fuels and other things that the kind of the Western lifestyle has. So their footprints are pretty small.
Well, my dog doesn't drive, but
But the bigger point I think is that yes, you can have kind of a small number of pets. I mean, clearly not one per household. That kind of average, partly because we are just more people. You know, a thousand years ago or longer, if you're talking about having some pets, first of all, in a tribe, right? It's not like every individual in a group or a community had their own dog. There was a dog or two in a community that served as guarding purposes or maybe protecting a flock of sheep. If that's what we're talking about, and you shared your dog with a few other friends, that would change the equation significantly. If you had a smaller dog that was consuming less, that changes the equation. If you had a productive dog that actually was serving some sort of purpose rather than just companionship, not that that's not an important purpose, but you know, friends could probably serve that role too. So there's all those questions. And in fact, that's why I personally kind of support the idea of trying to make more community-based dogs or more productive pets, those pets that will actually produce some food in the process.
Produce some food, meaning that they will be eaten or that they will...
Well, most people couldn't handle that, I think. Farmers have always had relationships with their animals and then could still understand that they get eaten at the end of their lives. Americans are probably way away from that place at this point, but you could have, pet chickens that lay eggs. You could have... I mean, that's kind of one of the only ones I can... you could have rabbits if you're willing to eat them at the end of their lives, but most people aren't.
I mean, you could also have dogs that herd your sheep if you have sheep.
Yeah,
or,
absolutely.
I know people who have border collies who actually take them out to farms outside of Portland where they can get their innate nature taken care of by learning how to herd sheep so they don't destroy the house when they come home. Actually, if you were just tuning in, we are talking this morning about if sustainability is possible with Eric Azadourian, who is the editor of World Watch's latest State of the World 2013, which is sustainability still possible. And in the last few moments of the show, let's talk about some of the ways that we are actually, or some concrete examples of changes that are being made or can be made so that we will still have a world we can live in 2100.
Sure. Yeah, I would actually maybe talk about that and also how we can make our world or our societies more resilient. Now, there's a whole third section this year in the report called Open in Case of Emergency, and it's really focusing on how do we make our societies more resilient while we have this window of stability. There are going to be some major uncomfortable changes in the future, and so the more we prepare now for those, and we can see the general way that they're going to unfold, the less suffering there will be from those. But before getting into that, there's clear ways that we can start making some changes now that can get us closer to a sustainable future. What we've been talking about is some cultural changes. How do we intentionally and proactively shift our culture away from consumerism and make it feel as natural to live sustainably as it does today to live like a consumer. And that's going to take the key societal institutions kind of pushing us in a new direction, whether we're talking about social enterprises kind of transforming what we understand as the role of business and the purpose of business. Is it really about maximizing profit, or is it creating a small company that actually improves the community or the broader situation for people? Government can play a very active role in shaping norms and cultural pathways. Social marketing can kind of combat some of the consumer marketing out there. But beyond cultural change, there's some really neat chapters that go into more concrete things, like there's one chapter on Keep 'em in the Ground is the main title. And it's really talking about trying to make it clear that there's much more fossil fuels in the Earth's crust than we should burn. Bill McKibben kind of drew a lot of attention to that in a Rolling Stone magazine where he highlighted that we have something like five times the fossil fuels in the Earth's crust than that would, if we actually burned all of it, it would cause 4, 5, 6 degrees of climate change, and bring us way beyond the 2 degrees of climate change that we're trying to keep it to. So if we recognize that there's all this fossil fuel, way more than is safe to burn, then we have to recognize that we should keep some of it in the ground, or in other words, not drill at all. And of course, that's easy to say, much harder to do when a fossil fuel company has already registered this reserve as theirs and has already monetized it in their accounting. So obviously, they're not going to want to keep that in the ground. But there's some great little examples in that chapter talking about how Ecuador, for example, has basically identified a huge reserve of oil under one of the most biodiverse hotspots in the world, the Yasuni National Park. And they made a plea to the international community saying, look, this is worth X hundred millions of dollars. If you will support us with about half of that, we'll eat the other half of the revenue that we would have gotten from this in order to protect this national park. And you know, they're basically asking for development aid and support in creating a renewable energy economy from the international community in exchange for indefinitely protecting this national park and keeping that fossil fuel in the ground.
That actually sounds like a carbon offset that really makes sense, as opposed to some of the bogus ones.
Yeah, exactly. And not only an offset, but even better in the sense that they're you know, it's not just keeping that carbon out of the game, but it's making sure that this really productive ecosystem is not going to be undermined. So it's a double benefit.
Now, you also this is also mentioned in the book about all these other resources besides fossil fuels that should probably stay in the ground too, that we could run out of, whether it's phosphorus, whether it's precious metals, there's lithium. I mean, all these things that are going into our high-tech present and some people think future. So let's talk a bit more about the wide range of non-renewable resources besides fossil fuels.
Sure. I think you're referring to the great chapter on conserving non-renewable resources by Gary Gardner, who really outlines all the different resources that our global economies depend on, and you know, kind of draws attention to the fact that these are often, just as you say, outside of the conversation. We're so focused on fossil fuels that the giant amounts of damage being done by drilling the copper or the lithium, this is being kind of overlooked, both the energy costs, both the degradation to the land, and so on. But we all, you know, this draws more support to the fact that, you know, rather than trying to find a technological solution that, you know, a new magic bullet that saves us, whether that's more solar panels or you know, some sort of technology that we haven't even dreamed up yet, sometimes the most sustainable path is just consuming less, is pulling back and recognizing that not every new gadget is going to make life better. And maybe, you know, city governments and national governments should be working actively and as quickly as possible not to switch from fossil fuel-based cars to electric cars, but actually foregoing the car altogether and moving towards a walkable, bikeable, and public transit-centric model, which will reduce not just fossil fuel emissions, but actually reduce lithium needs if we're not creating electric cars with big batteries, but metal needs and so on and so on.
Well, I think sometimes we feel like we're on this train that's moving, it's kind of like that uncontrollable, unengineered train that crashed in Quebec this weekend, but that we think we need so much and we keep thinking of the next high-tech gear. And one of the things that really struck me is I was having a conversation with some musician friends recently, and they're talking about how some orchestras are getting rid of paper music and using iPads, and you have the entire score on an iPad. And one of us brought up, well, musicians really need to write notes on their music, and you can't do that on an iPad. And I thought at that moment it was like this big epiphany for me, like, what's wrong with us going totally towards tablets and electronics and getting away from these much more personalized, individual, manual ways of doing things? So sometimes, I mean, there's nothing that can replace putting a slur or an accent mark on your music and, you know, having it very personalized about how you're going to play this particular phrase. So I wonder if that's something we can translate to a larger view of, like, what we gain by pulling back from barreling ahead into this high-tech future.
Yeah, it's hard because, I mean, there's no one marketing
pencils,
paper music sheets. Yeah, exactly, and pencils and the rest of it. It's the iPad is cool, and not only is it being marketed as cool, but there's a real benefit for everyone who switches to the iPad. For, you know, Apple, or for example, who actually gets to track, or Kindle, for example, they actually get to compile the data for everything that you read on the Kindle. So if it takes you 3 pages to read, 3 minutes to read a page, and kind of you're skipping over these pages, but or you're focusing on the mystery novels, they can target their marketing You can't do that if you're reading a paper book that you checked out from the library. No one is going to be able to get that information to market more mystery novels to you. So there's real benefits to the consumer model and those that are profiting from it to push us in this direction, not just in selling bits and bytes without any actual physical cost to them, but also in controlling the data and being even more effective in selling us more stuff that we don't need. So it's tough. I mean, I personally don't have an iPad or a Kindle, and I don't feel like I'm missing anything. I have a public library 4 blocks from me, so I barely even buy books because I can get whatever I want very easily. But we live in a society that is often, cutting social service expenditures, including for the local library, rather than actually increasing. I mean, the ideal is that most people aren't using Amazon or other major companies or even the local bookstore because most people are sharing books through the library. And that's not so economically beneficial, but people are spending less. They're using far fewer resources, and they still get the benefit of reading whatever they want and whenever they want. So there's there's a whole mindset that has to shift, and it's not normal because we are a very capital-centric or entrepreneurial culture, and that's going to have to kind of evolve.
Well, I wonder if we could end by talking a little bit more about that last chapter. Is it already too late?
Sure. Well, I'd even broaden slightly to that whole last section on open in case of emergency, because it really looks at real big issues, everything from kind of what resilience is, kind of a primer on resilience. It looks at the education, environmental education, which one would assume is helpful. As people graduate with environmental studies majors, in theory we should know more about environmental studies and how to kind of get ready for the future. But what the author finds is that the students are graduating with this naive idea that future disasters will enable us to kind of move towards sustainability more quickly. But in reality, disasters often push us down a more conservative path or reactionary path. So there's a real fear of governance going in the wrong direction as systems break down and destabilize. And in fact, there are 2 chapters in that section on governance, one on effective crisis governance and another by David Orr on governance in the long emergency. How do we strengthen our governance systems now and as systems are changing? So that we actually move faster towards sustainability, we prioritize resilience, and we don't kind of move down an autocratic path. So, chapters on all different topics, one on geoengineering, raising this question of is that really the right way to go to protect humanity and from changing climate, or maybe we should more strategically focus on preventing the climate from changing in the first place, and so on. And finally, Is It Too Late by Stan Robinson. He really looks at this question, and it's essentially a call to action to it's not too late, but we need to act strongly and quickly if we're going to prevent the huge amount of human and earth-based suffering that will come if we don't make some big changes.
Well, Eric, I want to thank you very much for joining us. And it's quite a monumental task you've put together here in Is Sustainability Still Possible? So thanks for being on Lucas Bookus.
It was very good to join you today.
We've been talking with Eric Asadourian, who's an editor of State of the World 2013, Is Sustainability Still Possible? And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, my guests are Sarah Canterbury and Rachel Freifelder with Living City, and we'll talk about year-round food production in your home and backyard. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Joe Clemens. We're going to go out with some music by Joni Mitchell. Thanks for listening.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KABU, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is Dr. Michael Murray. Dr. Murray is one of the world's leading authorities on natural medicine. He's the author of the best-selling Encyclopedia of Natural Medicine and nearly 30 other books on health-related topics. Dr. Murray is back on Health Watch today to talk about his book, What the Drug Companies Won't Tell You and Your Doctor Doesn't Know, the alternative treatments that may change your life and the prescriptions that could harm you, and particularly about five common over-the-counter and pharmaceutical medications.